Guten Abend und herzlich willkommen zum zweiten Tag 100 Jahre Copyright. And with this I switch to English, because our talks are in English language. So welcome everybody to 100 Years of Copyright, day two, where we start with the panel discussions and lectures. And before we do so, a short outlook on the program of today, which is quite dense, it's quite packed. After the keynote, we are going to have a panel discussion on money and morals, which I don't find at the moment. Anyway, and then at 8 o'clock, the concert program starts with a rewrite or a sound alike of the complete Sgt. Pepper album by General Salty and his original Rubber Band. Afterwards, it's reggae dub versions with Mark Inestis and Tiki Man, and Sister Nancy featuring Legal Shot. And still not the end, afterwards it's DJ Ripley with a really special DJ set. And now I hand over the stage to Aram Sinreich with his talk on music, tech, and copyright, a co-evolution in 5 moments. Aram.
Thank you, Detlef, and thank you all for being here. So before I start, I made this pledge to myself, which is very difficult to do, but I have to do it. 2 weeks ago, the United Nations came out with a report, the IPCC report, which has very dire warnings in it. Basically what the, for those of you who don't read the news, I don't know if there are any Germans who don't read the news, but in the US we have a lot. What they said is that humanity has 12 years to change our entire technological and economic infrastructure to eliminate climate change contributions by carbon, or else we're fucked. Like, we're really screwed. Our species will begin to experience devastation on a scale that we've never known throughout our history. By the year 2040, which is only 22 years away. As the father of two young children, this disturbs me and concerns me to a great degree. That's pretty much all I think about now, which is too bad because my favorite things to think about are music and copyright and technology. So what I pledged is, you know, I'm not a scientist. I can't fix climate change. I can't invent the next technology that's going to save the world. There's very little that I can do in the realm of politics, and what I do is mostly about copyright. So what I can do is I give a lot of speeches. I do a lot of public speaking. So my contribution to this process is to make sure that I never give a public speech in the next 12 years without first mentioning that we have 12 years and counting to fix this technological problem that's going to destroy our societies and possibly extinguish our species. So I'd like each of you in your own ways to think about what kind of power you have to contribute to stopping this before it's too late. If you give public talks, give public talks. If you play a role in government, play a role in government. If you're a scientist, maybe think about changing careers and moving into climate science. And if you already work in climate science and policy, thank you. From the bottom of my heart, I hope you're successful. Okay, sorry to be a downer at the beginning of this excellent events, but I really, like I said, made a pledge to myself and I have to fulfill it. So let's talk about more less important, but very important and more interesting subjects, which are music, tech, and copyright. So the subject of this whole conference is the relationship between copyright as a legal system and our cultural systems, especially music, but culture, art, public letters, the public sphere in general, and specifically how the last 100 years have shown a kind of interplay between these two things. Fortunately, that's exactly what my talk is about. I'm going to go a little bit further back, and I'm going to talk about a little bit more than just music and copyright, but you'll see. I'm actually proposing, and this is a kind of new theoretical direction for the work, for those of you who've read my books, where I'm talking about 5 different steps in this ongoing cycle that shows this relationship between music and copyright. So first of all, we have laws and regulations. Copyright is obviously the most important law that affects music and culture, but there are many, many more intellectual property laws like patents and trademarks, but even regulations about how the internet operates or how media organizations are allowed to do their business or to merge or to acquire one another. These laws and regulations don't directly affect musical culture. What they affect is the way that markets work, the way that people trade in musical artifacts, buying and selling, playing music on the radio, downloading music over the internet or streaming or what have you. These market dynamics shape the kinds of musical codes and musical practices that both musicians and audiences, although I think there's not as much of a difference between those two as some people would think, that was a large part of what my book Mashed Up was about. So these codes and practices change because of the changing markets, which in turn change the way that music technologies evolve. And I'm talking both about music technologies like the laptop that's used by a DJ, but also music technologies like the laptop that's used by somebody working at Spotify or somebody working at a radio station. Or an end consumer who's listening to music or wants to remix it or what have you. These music technologies, in turn, change our social understanding of what it means to be a creator, what it means to be an artist, what it means to be an author. And this is really important because if you look historically at copyright and if you look historically at the concept, at art history, really, as I'm sure many of you have, we have always treated the category of the artist as a kind of stand-in for the category of the individual. And as artists have been increasingly perceived over the years as individuals and as beings with natural rights, or droit moral, as they say in France, so has our conception of who these individuals that constitute society are. We understand ourselves through our conception of the artist, is really the shortest, sweetest way of saying it. And those concepts of authorship, in turn, shape the way that law changes. So we have this never-ending cycle between these five kinds of moments, as I like to call them, that just spiral and spiral and spiral. And there's not a single path through history. There are many, many different ways in which laws influence markets and codes influence technologies and concepts influence laws. So what I'm gonna do today is I'm gonna take you through one cycle, one of many, 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 many spirals we could draw through musical and technological and legal history. And I'm gonna start way further back than 100 years. I'm gonna start back in the Renaissance. But I promise I'll get to the last century pretty quick, and then I'm going to end up more or less in the present day. So if you look before the Renaissance, if you look at, you know, the beginnings of what we now call modernity in history, there was no copyright, and there were no music markets, and there were no music industries as we would think of them today, but there was a lot of music. And of course, as always, throughout human history, music was controlled by powerful institutions, because whoever controls the music controls the society, partially for the reasons I was just talking about. Who were these powerful institutions? Well, there were really two. On the one hand, you had church music, and as those of you who are historians of music know, the church really got its fingers deep into music for a long time. Hildegard von Bingen, who's here, I wrote about her in one of my books, you know, there was this massive battle over whether she could even be allowed to play music in her masses, even though she was the most celebrated composer of her era, in large part because the prelates of Mainz basically got jealous that a powerful woman was steering the church, and they wanted to step on her and make sure it stopped. But the court, the royal courts and the aristocratic system that existed up until 100 years ago was also really central to controlling music. And if those of you who are interested in this kind of thing have read it, you know, you can read the letters that, like, Johann Sebastian Bach wrote with his courtly sponsors, his patrons, where they would, like, get into it, and they'd be like, no, you can't use that harmony here. You have to change that note. You have to change that chord progression, right? But then this thing happens, which is the Renaissance. And what starts to happen is that humans start in the West, in Europe, start to organize their societies according to this kind of newly emergent bourgeoisie. And the bourgeoisie was separate from both the court and the church to a large degree. And their currency was currency. Their currency was money. And so what you see is these new forms of music emerging back at the time, like Ars Nova, that were actually more sophisticated and more complex and more interesting than the music that was in the church or in the court, in large part because there was nobody trying to step on the musicians and saying, no, you can't do that. Right? There was only which music is going to appeal to what we would now call the consumers. And this change in market dynamics led to severe changes in musical practice. Not only did new styles like Ars Nova emerge, but our whole conception of what it means to make music changed. And one of the things that we saw was a division of labor between the people responsible for writing the music, the composers, and the people responsible for making the music into sounds, the performers. And just like every other industry, because music began to be an industry at this point, we saw this division of labor map along class lines, where the composers did the knowledge labor, they were the white-collar workers, and they were better respected and better paid, and the performers were the manual labor, they were the blue-collar workers, and they were less respected and less well-paid. And this division of labor obviously continues through this day. Now, this change in musical codes and practices was reflected in the changes in musical technology. When we first saw Gutenberg's press emerge, it was obviously used for a Bible, and then it was used for texts. But within 100 years, it began to be used for music and adapted for the purposes of printing sheet music. We also saw massive architectural changes, where for the first time we saw the emergence of this new musical art form called opera. But in order to have opera, you had to have a place to play the music, because it wasn't the church and it wasn't the royal court. It was a third place, a place sponsored, patronized, paid for by the bourgeoisie through ticket sales. And the opera required whole new buildings, opera houses, to be built. And architected into those opera houses were the division between the performer and the audience, the proscenium that separated those of us back here, the performers, from those of you out there, the audience, which kind of architecturally reinforced this division that hadn't really existed to the same degree prior to that point. Now, this change in technology leads to the concept of composers as being the great innovators in music. And this is the era, the Baroque era, the classical era, the 17th and 18th centuries, where, you know, a lot of Germans and Austrians were celebrated as being the great composers. And even now, to this day, they're seen as great composers. And what made them great was this new idea that hadn't existed before, which was that they were geniuses, that God had somehow touched them and given them access to some kind of beautiful music of the cosmos that other people, normal people like you and me, didn't have access to. They were special people, right? Sounds a little familiar from some political ideologies that maybe we don't all subscribe to here. But what was interesting was copyright still didn't exist, at least not for music. So what we had was even these great composers who were celebrated for being so original and so different and so unique frequently borrowed music from one another. So if you look at, for instance, Mozart and Handel, two of the great composers who are still celebrated to this day, well, you hear this Kyrie Eleison by Mozart. Well, it turns out that was pretty much directly borrowed from Handel. And I'm not proposing that Handel was the victim of a ripoff or a theft. I mean, Handel himself was notorious for musical borrowing, and even borrowed for himself, like the Hallelujah chorus borrowed two things that he had previously written in other works. And this continues. So if you look at, the greatest genius of all in the Western musical tradition, Beethoven, the Moor of Bonn, no disrespect to anyone from Bonn here, Mozart was a massive source of inspiration and, you could say, theft or borrowing for Beethoven. So this is a famous one. Here's the Ode to Joy. What a beautiful melody. Only the genius of Beethoven could have created this perfect melody. Only it was the genius of Mozart. He didn't have the rhythm. He wasn't the Moor of Vienna, but he had the melody down. Okay, so that leads to this new kind of law and regulation, which is the invention of musical copyright. As soon as you have the concept of great composers, you start to have this notion that supports, and this is where we get into the 100 years of copyright. So here's an actual score of Wagner's, and as you can see, you begin to see the copyright notice actually printed at the bottom of a score. It becomes physically and conceptually unremovable from the artwork itself. right? The product of art carries along the imprimatur saying this and only this is this. And no one else can do this or have this because only this person can make this and own this. That leads to this market dynamic, which is the massive growth during the 19th century of a publishing, a music publishing industry. This is from New York, where I'm from originally. This was called Tin Pan Alley, but there were many similar publishing industries emerging around the world that basically once music is a product that you can monopolize through the ownership over the copyright, you have industries that build cartels that kind of control the distribution of that product. And by so doing, control the distribution of music in society and control the codes and practices and practitioners and say who can do what and what kind of music can be made and what kind of music can be heard. Once you get that massive infrastructure, that cartel, which controlled everything, what appeared in stores through song pluggers, what we now call payola, they influenced what kinds of music singers would sing, what kind of music musicians would play. You get this kind of like panic attack among the professional musicians who are like, shit, we can't borrow from each other anymore because we're gonna get sued. So what do? Do they stop borrowing? No, they don't stop borrowing. There's no such thing as a musician who doesn't borrow. What they start doing is they start borrowing from people who don't have copyright. So what that means is like they suddenly discover that Asians and Africans and Central Americans make music, and all those poor people who don't have lawyers and don't know what lawyers are also make music, and they call it Orientalism, and they call it folk music. And this was known and this was understood at the time. Right? If you look at Robert Schumann actually wrote A Guide for Musicians, where he used the extractive metaphor, the notion that you were mining, directly in his advice for musicians. Go and mine the folk songs. They're the source of the most beautiful melodies. Right? This is a fundamentally industrialist capitalist logic that's now being applied to music because copyright exists. Now, this only becomes a problem when people fall afoul of it, when people accidentally violate the rules. So there's a great example of a French composer who writes an opera that's based on some lovely Spanish folk songs. You've all heard Carmen by Georges Bizet. Here's a lovely rendition of the Habanera by Maria Callas. This song was a massive hit. It was an international sensation. As soon as the opera debuted in 1875, like internationally, people went bonkers for it. Like everybody who had a piano had to have a copy of the sheet music. And you know, that made a bonanza for their publishing empire behind Carmen. The only problem was that Bizet didn't take it as he probably thought he did from an anonymous and non-lawyer knowing Spanish folk musician. He got it from a well-known Spanish composer named Sebastián Iradier. So that's a song called El Arreglito, which was actually published about 10 years before Bizet published Carmen. And, you know, if Bizet had just taken it from an anonymous folk musician, that would not have been a problem. And everybody would still be talking about what a great genius Bizet was for coming up with the Habanera. But because the song that he thought was folk music was actually owned, was copyrighted by Sebastián Iradier, it became a massive legal battle. And even though Bizet and Iradier had both died by 1876, by the point that the legal battle began, the two publishing companies went at it for like 10 or 20 years in multiple, it was like the Apple versus Samsung of the late 19th century. It was like this massive, because so much money was on the line because this song was such a massive hit. So the stinger, the kind of punchline to this story is that Iradier didn't write the melody either. Iradier went on a well-documented fact-finding trip to Latin America about 10 years before he wrote El Arreglito, and that was probably where he encountered this melody, right? And nobody has ever sued on behalf of those anonymous Central American musicians who were probably the original source of that melody, although who knows who they took it from. Okay, so that leads us to the beginning of the 20th century and the last 100 years of copyright. So these two new technologies whose have fascinating histories that I don't have time to get into, become the dominant music technologies in the early 20th century. You have sound recording on the left, and you have radio on the right. And what I'm going to point out is the only thing I'll mention about these technologies at this point is that neither of them was actually envisioned as a music technology. When Edison first created his wax cylinders that recorded sound, he actually published a list of things that he thought people could do with a phonograph. And he said, well, you could learn a language, or a wealthy businessman could fire his secretary and use it to dictate letters, or you could have books read out loud to you. Oh yeah, and you could have music, and you could have this thing and that thing and the other thing. Like, music was way down on the list for Edison. And for radio, for those of you who know some of radio history, I know Larissa Mann, DJ Ripley, is in the back row over there, and she's worked a lot on the subject of low-power FM. Radio began as a peer-to-peer medium, where hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. alone would get on their homemade radio sets, each of which was both a sender and a receiver, and they would have conversations and play music to each other and gossip all night long, every night. And that only ended in the U.S. after the U.S. government stepped in and basically stole the radio spectrum from the people, first during World War I for military reasons, and then after World War I, in large part because a guy named Herbert Hoover wanted to get in good with the federal government, so he created the federal apparatus to monopolize radio airwaves and led to the kind of creation of radio networks that we still know today. Right? So these are two technologies that had very different purposes when they were created that soon got sucked into this this economic and market structure of stockpiling music and distributing it for profit. Okay, now these new music technologies lead to a new concept of authorship, beginning in the right after World War II, when magnetic tape becomes massively available to Americans because it was some of our war spoils from Germany. We started seeing this massive uptick in people who were musicians who didn't create with traditional instruments, but instead created with recording technologies, right? You have John Cage on the upper left, John Lennon and Yoko Ono. Anyone know who's on the lower left here? Very important innovators. Yeah. Les Paul and Mary Ford, absolutely. Yeah, and then on the lower right, say again? Lee Scratch Perry.
Show up, play on, Mr. Music, play on, won't you? Play on, Mr. Music, play on, rather than the corner. Rather than the corner, is licking the sleep, the drama's about to roll.
The Black Art in action. Right? So this is a totally new conception of what it means to be a composer, right? Now composing isn't putting notes on a page, let alone improvising a song as you're walking along on your lute or guitar. Composing is the act of taking pieces of recorded sound and assembling them into a configuration that nobody has heard before, right? And that leads, for better and for worse, in the 1960s to an international treaty that creates the foundations for a phonographic copyright. For the first time, so since 1830 in the US, even earlier in France and the UK, I'm not sure about Germany, but it's around the beginning of the 19th century, you have a copyright for the composition of a song, for the song that somebody has written, as it appears in ink on a page. Now you have this new kind of music that cannot appear as ink on a page, and so you get this new kind of copyright where you own the sound of the music as it appears on the phono recording. And in the US, this became law in 1972. And I don't know if you guys follow American news outside of the blowhard bastard who's destroying our country and our world, but this very important thing just happened about a week or two ago, where Congress and the White House enacted a new law called the Music Modernization Act, which basically took all of the music, all of the phono recordings made prior to 1972, which had been in the public domain and belonged to us, the American people, and have now given them retroactively to the corporate cartels and said, well, it doesn't matter when it was recorded, you still own the phono recording. Okay, so we now have this new form of copyright, and it has the same kind of effect on the marketplace that the creation of music copyright for compositions had 150 years earlier, which is that they start to stockpile and they reorganize their business over lawsuits. And so this is actually a bar graph of all of the music infringement decisions that have made it all the way through to a federal judge deciding in a court case in the US. And you can see, beginning in the second half of the 20th century, the number climbs precipitously, right? This becomes a lawsuit-based industry, the music industry, in the second half of the 20th century. You can see in the first 17 years of the 21st century, we've almost hit the same number in the US that we had in the 50 years prior to that. And if it keeps going at this rate, without accelerating, it'll be 180 lawsuits by 2049, probably even more. So then this really interesting thing happens, which is that as soon as all of the traditional distribution channels begin to get cartelized and owned by industry, musical innovation starts to happen in the handful of places that are not controlled. Right? This is a playground in the Bronx, New York. This happens to be right across the street from where my wife grew up. And my mother-in-law, who's a great musician and a great lover of music, tried her very best to kill hip-hop by calling the police every time DJ Kool Herc was out in the playground across the street from her house with the massive sound system, playing the same little piece of music over and over again, which drove her crazy. She's since come around. She's very much a fan of hip-hop. But back in 1976, she wasn't so much of a fan. Okay, so you have Kool Herc in the Bronx and many others pioneering hip-hop, which is this music that is really a détournement, right? It takes a playback device, the turntable, and it turns it into a musical device. And there's no copyright lawyers around. So you can sample, and you can beat juggle, and you can scratch, and you can do whatever you want, because it's a completely unregulated space. They didn't even have their own electricity. They would plug the electrical cords, the cables, into like my wife's building and run it across the street into the playground. So then what you have is that the new aesthetic, the new practices begin to yield new music technologies. So you see the creation of the first drum machine, this first sampler, the first digital audio workstation, all within a couple of years, all within really 20 years of the birth of hip hop, right? And these are new musical instruments that are created for the purpose of enabling production as composition, for enabling a circular rhythmic logic, a kind of layered timbral aesthetic, right? These are not instruments that are made to make music that's written on the page. These are instruments that are made to make music that is encoded on magnetic tape or a piece of vinyl. And of course, that changes the way that we think of authorship. Now, there was a massive kind of rejection of what we would now call romantic concepts of authorship, the great composer model, among musicians who make electronic or cut and paste based music. These are just a handful of what I think are very funny puns in sample-based music titles. You have The Streets saying everything is borrowed. You have Plunderphonic calling John Oswald calling his project like plunder, like stealing. You have the Beastie Boys' first song on their first album, Rhymin' and Stealin'. You have the Executioners, this is my favorite of them, Built from Scratch. That's like the best double entendre in the history of music, right? Because they're scratching, but in American idiom, built from scratch means built with ingredients that are pure, that didn't used to be part of something else, right? So they're playing with this notion of originality because their mode of musical production rejects the concept of originality. It's impossible to be original in this setting, so you may as well embrace the moniker of the pirate, the moniker of the thief. That leads to a big crackdown by the legacy industries, which through both lawsuits and new laws try their best to stop people from poaching music without permission. So what that means is the creation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and the copyright directive here in the EU. We see major lawsuits. The only major successful lawsuits for sampling are against African American musicians, by the way, in the United States. This is a highly raced subject. Biz Markie, you can.
We may as well go home as I did on my.
So this is Gilbert O'Sullivan with a very minor hit. And then you can hear what Biz did with it.
I'm alone again, naturally. Alone again, naturally. So I went into the show. show and started massive.
And you could say, okay, well, he's even recycling some of the language there. So maybe that is, like, maybe he should have gotten permission, right? Well, let's look at the other major copyright lawsuit that essentially killed sampling in hip-hop in the United States. This one begins with... Now, because I am not as creative as some musicians, I would have used that pickup drum beat as like the thing that I sampled. But actually, what NWA used was the electric guitar part. So I actually want to try something with you guys. Raise your hand when you hear the sample.
Reasons, I don't give a fuck. Chances are usually not good. Cause I first whip my hands on a hot hood. I'm getting jacked by the you know who. When in a black and white, the capacity is two. But not alone with three more brothers. I mean street brothers. Not wearing my tights because we're not stupid motherfuckers. They have to take our heads for what we said in the past. Point blank, they can kiss my black ass.
Y'all missed it, right? That guitar, that Eddie Hazel's guitar is in the mix. But it sounds like a police siren. You can't hear it. And the only reason they got sued was because they bragged about having used it in order to give props to George Clinton and Eddie Hazel in an interview. And then the trolls that own the copyright to Funkadelic's music sued them for copyright infringement and won. And that essentially shut down all sampling for commercial music in the US for 15 years. And the judge didn't cite copyright law exclusively in his decision in the Bismarcky case. He actually cited the Bible. He said, thou shalt not steal. Which, for those of you who don't know American law, the Bible has no precedent, right? American law is not based on the Bible. It's based on the Constitution, which was not cited. Okay, so then we have, thanks to these new lawsuits and new powers in the hands of the major labels and the rest of the copyright monopolists in the music field, we got this massive flight of lawsuits in the late 1990s, early 2000s, and I actually have a whole chapter about this in my book, The Piracy Crusade, where I interview all these people who started these really interesting new digital music services in the 90s and the 2000s, and they all have exactly the same story, which is that they create the service, if they ask for permission, the record labels say no, and if they don't ask for permission, the record labels sue them. Either way, the labels ask them for millions of dollars that they don't have and a major stake of equity in their companies. And if they say no, then they go out of business. And if they say yes, they go out of business. Which is why so few of these companies, only DatPiff and Mixcloud are still, and the Napster brand exists, but not Napster the company. Mixcloud just signed its first major record label licensing deal like a week or two ago, which is too bad because this is my favorite place to hear new music, and now I'm going to have to find a new unregulated space to find it. What's interesting is when I was writing that book, I actually interviewed the guy who was the head of licensing at Universal, which was the biggest music label, from the mid-90s through the mid-2000s, this guy Larry Kenswell. And I was like, Larry, what are you thinking? Like, you're killing all of these new channels for music distribution that's gonna get you all of your new customers. Like, why would you do that? Like, you're literally, like, not literally, but you're figuratively killing the goose that laid the golden egg. And Larry says, and on the recording, you can hear my jaw hitting the table when he said this to me. He said, the attitude of the labels at the time was, why license them and make a little when you can sue them and make a lot? That's how short-sighted music industry strategy is, right? It's all about this quarter, right? These are public companies. How much money are we going to be able to show on our balance sheets this quarter? And of course, it shows that the lawyers in the house, not the A&R people or the marketing people, are the ones who are really steering the ship, which is a problem that I don't have time to get into. So what happens? Hip-hop dies in the mid-2000s. You get a real kind of stagnation aesthetically. You get the market starting to stagnate and starting to age. And you have Nas, you know, the apostle of the death of hip-hop, proclaiming that hip-hop is dead. But it doesn't really die, because it's kind of reborn at the same time. But it's not reborn on the radio, and it's not reborn on the internet, and it's not reborn, in the clubs. It's reborn in unregulated spaces, just like the place where hip hop was originally born, right? In the US, there's this whole mixtape network that is a sneaker net. It's a physical network of strip clubs and barber shops and corner stores, and that's where the new music thrived. And in Europe, you actually have a similar phenomenon with EDM, which is of course now very big business. But that leads to the really interesting change, which is that you start to get the music that emerges in these unregulated spaces, which are in the American South, begins to take over hip hop culture in general. So I mentioned before, I'm a New Yorker. I come from Brooklyn, New York, right? And my wife comes from the Bronx. And we have a very specific notion of what music from New York sounds like. This is the biggest hip hop song to come out of New York in recent history.
You know where I'm at, you know where I be. You run the club, just to party. I'm there, I get paid a fee. I be in and out them banks so much I know they tired of me. Honestly, don't give a fuck about who in front of me.
Now, no disrespect, Cardi B is great, but it doesn't sound like New York. It sounds like the American South, right? So the new aesthetic that emerges in these southern mixtape networks becomes the dominant global aesthetic for the same reason that hip-hop originally became a dominant global aesthetic. It's the one place where the copyright police aren't trying to shut down every new idea that emerges. Now that leads to this new set of music technologies, both on the cat side and the mouse side. On the cat side, you have stuff like Audible Magic, this fingerprinting technology that gets baked into all of these music platforms so that as soon as you upload something that contains copyrighted content, you're alerted and you might even get your stuff taken down. Here in Europe, you're dealing with this new Article 13 of the new copyright directive, and it's actually mandating that this technology be integrated into every platform, including the ISPs, that you proactively censor the entire internet just in case somebody falls afoul of copyright laws. But at the same time, you also have the mouse. And the mouse is happening on both the creative side and on the distribution side. On the creative side, you have these new digital audio environments like Ableton Live, which are created for working DJs in real time to change and obscure their samples in ways that the old-fashioned digital audio workstations, let alone turntables, weren't that good at, right? Evade the police, hide the sample, change the sample. And at the same time, on the infrastructure side, you have these new privacy services like the Onion Router Tor, which allow you to kind of distribute music in a way that's encrypted, that's hidden from the prying eyes of the ISPs. So if you want to distribute something that might be censored by them, you can just, and this is a pro tip, you can encrypt it using Tor or a VPN or a private channel that's encrypted like Signal or even WhatsApp. WhatsApp is great for sending things that Article 13 can't flag. One to know. Okay, then you get this new concept of authorship. We already had the notion that production could be composition back in the mid-20th century, but now you have the rise of the so-called super producers. And the super producers aren't just producers like Teo Macero, who produced Kind of Blue, or George Martin, who produced Sgt. Pepper's, which we're gonna be hearing a reenactment of in an hour or two, which I'll be very interested to hear. These producers are the primary artists. And when other artists participate with them, those artists are relegated to the secondary position of being featured. It's not Justin Bieber, producer DJ Khaled, it's DJ Khaled featuring Justin Bieber, right? So there's an inversion of where the power is in the industry. And now we have an entirely producer-driven industry, thanks to the prominence of these modes of musical production. Now that leads to a change in the laws. So for the last 20, 30 years, we've had these horrible, horrible laws saying that no sampling can ever even be fair use or de minimis, which in the US context are cases where it's legal to use somebody else's work without permission or without paying. Just in the last 4 years in the US, we've seen 3 major lawsuits by major artists like Jay-Z, Madonna, and Drake that have found that they have sampled without permission without breaking the law. In the first 2 cases, Jay-Z and Madonna, the samples were found to be so small that they didn't count, right? They weren't big enough samples to be copyrightable, which was a huge win. It's much better than Thou Shalt Not Steal, Bismarcky, right? But with Drake, you actually have the fair use argument, which says that, well, you can hear the sample, but he changed its meaning so that it's something different, and therefore he didn't need permission. And that's where we're at now. So we're actually, I think, on a little bit of an upswing. We're beginning to see, and this was predicted years ago by legal scholars. I interviewed this guy, Gary Edelman, for my first book, Mashed Up. And Gary Edelman is a lawyer who also founded the electronic music label Liquid Sky in New York. And I was like, Gary, what's going to happen? When's this going to change? And he was like, yeah, write big ups to Liquid Sky. And Gary was like, don't worry. Like, all the people who are in law school now grew up with hip-hop and sample-based music. And when they're judges, they're going to change the laws. And he was 100% right. That's exactly what's happening now. So I'm not proposing we're at the end of something. We're in the middle of something that started way before the Renaissance. It's going to go on as long as there are human beings on this planet, which hopefully will be past the year 2040. And there are many, many different paths. I didn't even talk about the Eastern Hemisphere. I barely talked about the Global South, right? But this is actually how I think music works. I think there's this five-stage process that continues and continues and continues. And you can't understand musical changes unless you understand legal changes, unless you understand technological changes, right? They're all deeply intertwined with each other forever and always. That's it for me right now. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer questions if we have time. I'm schwitzing up here. You guys say schwitz? That's the American word.
My question is to me it seems like the people who were sued were black people, people of color.
Yeah, that's not a question, but it's true. There's another story that I could tell, that I don't have time to tell right now, about the ways in which music laws have always been used to oppress, to further oppress people who are systematically oppressed within society. And that's not just an American thing, that's throughout history. And it goes way, way back, thousands of years. But in the American context, music laws have been used to silence and threaten and impoverish black people for many, many, many years, going back to slavery days. And there's a shameful history of this that goes through the period of what was called minstrelsy, which involved all the blackface stuff that you guys might know about. In the early 20th century, American jazz musicians were targeted with all of these what were called cabaret laws that basically told them when and where and what they could play. And what was interesting was when I was a young musician in New York in the 1990s, Rudy Giuliani, who was mayor of New York at the time, revived these 50, 60, 70-year-old racist cabaret laws and started enforcing them again. And that was the point at which New York started to be a place that musicians couldn't play as freely. So you're absolutely right. And there are some interesting contrasts as well. So for instance, I talked about the NWA lawsuit that they lost for sampling that unrecognizable 2 seconds of the Funkadelic guitar solo. At the same time, the Beastie Boys, who were white, were facing a very similar lawsuit by a black avant-garde musician named James Newton. And in that case, it was a much more recognizable solo that was much more integral as a sample in the finished product, and they successfully defended their suit. So yeah, it's definitely disproportionately discriminatory against African Americans. Yes? You with the headphones. Oh, that's a great question. So in the US, you cannot make what's known as a bootleg recording without permission of the performer. But there's a long history of there being markets for bootleg recordings that are kind of unregulated or underregulated. In some cases, the bands, you know, bands like the Grateful Dead and Pearl Jam have actually historically encouraged their fans to make and circulate and even sell bootlegs. And what they figure is that it comes back to them economically in creating new fans and stronger fan communities. But there are other artists who feel the opposite. I've been at concerts, like small, I remember seeing the great reed player Don Byron playing at the Knitting Factory in maybe in the 1997 or something. And he just saw like somebody sitting in the front row holding a little mini disc player. And he just got off, he stopped playing, put down his clarinet, got off stage, took the kid's mini disc player, ejected the mini disc, put it in his pocket and gave it back to the kid. And then went back up onto stage and started playing again. Which one were you, the recorder or the player? So she was recording you playing? That's amazing. Yeah. I think it's much less policed now because everybody has a recording device in their pocket that can capture high definition video as well as audio. But companies like Apple do have patents that would allow a venue like this to remotely disable the recording devices on all of your phones with a click of a button. To my knowledge, they've never actually used it, but they can. It's in your phone. So cat and mouse. Any other questions? Yeah.
Yes, I would like to go back a bit to the part where you showed these little smaller or platforms that started small and then they got kind of screwed by the bigger, yes, thank you. The case of Mixcloud, I would like to hear more details about it, because if we compare in the last year, like between Mixcloud and SoundCloud, Mixcloud, they kind of managed to keep going on without much trouble. You mentioned something that I would like you to maybe explain a bit more, but
sure.
SoundCloud, they went through some problems and
yeah.
Now it's still above water, but maybe you would, could you explain a bit more about the model that they use, Mixcloud, how to keep on above water versus SoundCloud?
Yeah, sure. And what I should remind you, and this I didn't explain enough in my talk, record labels are not monolithic entities. They have different people working in different capacities inside them who have very different opinions and different jobs. So, for instance, at the beginning of my book, Mashed Up, I have an interview with a mixtape producer, DJ Drama. And DJ Drama, in 2005 or something like that, like 50 police officers, SWAT teams with guns and dogs, came and broke down his door and confiscated all the material in his studio, in the Affiliate Network studio. And the only reason was in order to find contraband CDs, which were mixtape CDs containing copyrighted material. What I found out when I interviewed him is that he had been paid $30,000 by a major record label to include their music on that mixtape. And then that record label went around and hired the police to arrest him for doing what they had paid him to do, right? That's the legal department on the one side and the promotion department on the other side, right? Working at cross purposes to each other. And so the whole industry is organized that way. So a platform like mixtape, like Mixcloud or SoundCloud, you have the promotion departments actually sending, you know, advance singles and acapellas and all kinds of other materials to DJs who are prominent on these platforms, because being included in a mixtape can get you a lot more fans and a lot more sales. But at the same time, the record labels are trying to license them so that they make money every time anything is played, and so that they can't play their music without permission, which eventually kills all the networks, because there's no business model that allows a Mixcloud or a SoundCloud to stay alive if they're paying, you know, some kind of industry determined rate every time they play any song. So what happens is these websites emerge, and then they get very popular among musicians and fans and promotion executives at record labels. And then the legal departments recognize that they're there, and they either shut them down or they shake them down. And then they go out of business, and then a new one emerges. And it happens over and over and over again. And I've watched it happen since I was a digital music industry analyst in the mid to late 1990s. And and like I say, if you're interested in that, my book, The Piracy Crusade, is actually available for free online at piracycrusade.com. You can download the whole book. Chapter 7, I tell a bunch of identical stories that happened between the 1990s and the 2010s that, you know, it's exactly the same story over and over and over again. Yes?
Hi, everyone. I'm Frank from WOMEX, WOMEX World Music Exposition Platform for Cultural Diversity About Music. I have a question. What is your stance, what is your opinion about blockchain technology coming up? Because I see here the bad players, the bad intermediates, they can all be cut out for direct exchange between musician and consumer, and then it all will be tracked and distributed fairly.
Okay, that's a good question. First of all, I want to shout out my friend and colleague, Laura Donardis, who works with me at American University. She got me a t-shirt that says, you had me at blockchain, which I wear all the time, and you did have me at blockchain. So there's a lot of, I was at an event about this a couple of years ago with D.A. Wallach, where we talked through it. There's a lot of hope that because blockchain can keep track of every single transaction of any kind, whether it's a piece of music flowing over the internet or a piece of money flowing from one company to another, that it can somehow like split the middle between unregulated and hyper-regulated spaces. The problem with the blockchain dream is that the music industry was built with the expectation that there would be a lot of leakage, that there would be a lot of unregulated spaces, right? Just like, you know, we don't get arrested every time we break the law. Like, I've crossed the street against the light like 20 times since I got to Berlin last night, and I haven't been arrested any of those times. If they wanted to arrest me every time that happened, let's say they set up a bunch of like low-cost drones with cameras on them, and every time I crossed the street, which they probably will, and every time I crossed the street against the light, I got like a ticket for $50, I would go bankrupt. Or I would never get anywhere because I'd have to wait for the light every time, and I would have been half an hour late for this talk today. Right? So systems only work when there's a certain amount of flexibility baked into them. And blockchain doesn't allow for that. There simply is not enough money being generated through musical activity to pay every creator every time any of their creations is heard or used by anybody in any way. On top of that problem, and this is more of a problem in the US, fortunately for us Americans, than it is in the EU, we have something called fair use, which is what got Drake out of trouble in the case of Lemon Cake. Right? Fair use says you can use other people's stuff that's copyrighted and not break the law because you have a First Amendment right to express yourself, and there are all kinds of cases in which you know, you might be sampling or you might be even, you know, copying something or storing something. You don't need permission. There's no way for blockchain to know what's fair use and what's not fair use. They'll just see every transaction as being equal. You can't engineer that into the platform because, at least in the American context, fair use can only be determined through a legal process that takes into account cultural context. So I actually have a whole other article, which I guess I'll promote since I'm on stage, which I wrote for, where is he, Eberhard? Right there, right? That's basically about all of the ways in which algorithmic copyright enforcement is the end of Western liberal civilization. And it's, I think it's a pretty convincing argument. But if you're really interested in that, my email address is up here, and you can email me, and I will send you a copy of that article. But basically, machines can't think culturally is the reason why the blockchain dream will never happen. Yes?
I have a question about licensing, and this time not licensing to distributors, but licensing samples for music production. So you had this Bridgeport decision, get a license or do not sample.
Right.
And it didn't mean the end of sampling.
That was the NWA case that I talked about.
Yeah, but it meant that licensing, that sampling was channeled into the big music producing companies.
Right.
So they had their in-house contracts with artists under contract, and they could use samples from their catalog, or perhaps they could use samples from other companies, and the legal department settle all the claims.
Right.
Can you tell us a bit more about how much money is involved in this licensing market?
Sure. So, yeah.
And how it transforms the role of the sampling musician, because they're forced to follow the tracks that have been
Absolutely.
Predetermined by the legal departments.
So I'll answer that as briefly as I can, because we're probably running out of time. So in America, And in a lot of other regimes around the world, including Germany, if you want to cover a song that somebody has written, you don't have to ask their permission. You do have to pay them, but you pay them a small amount, a mechanical royalty, if you're making a recording, that in the US is determined by Congress. And that's affordable. That's baked into the price of doing business. We don't have a similar right for remix in the US, which Lawrence Lessig and others have argued that we should. So if you want to sample someone's work, they can charge you as much money as they want. Right? Now, because most of the work is controlled by major publishers and major record labels, they have a long-standing practice, especially since the NWA lawsuit, which basically says that if you want to sample, like, only major labels will sample to only other major labels. And they'll ask for, you know, tens of thousands of dollars per sample, rather than something that an independent musician or independent label can afford. And in that way, only hip-hop and sample-based musics can only be distributed commercially. I'm excluding underground markets here, non-commercial markets, can only be distributed commercially through cartels that are well-funded and that are willing to play nice with each other. And so what happens as soon as that starts to happen is you see the growth of this new hip-hop aesthetic, where instead of NWA and Public Enemy and A Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul and all these kind of early 90s, late 80s artists who are like building like beautiful sonic collages, you begin to get hip-hop that uses like one sample in a very boring way. Like, my favorite bad example is I'll Be Missing You by Puffy. But everyone has their own favorite bad example, right? But I'll Be Missing You is just The Police with a backbeat under it, and then Puffy like being like making some very boring, supposedly heartfelt raps about how much he misses his friend Biggie Smalls. Not really an interesting song. Not a classic. Nobody listens to it anymore. It's not a good song, right? And so that's the point at which hip-hop starts to become aesthetically stale in the American commercial context, which leads up to that point that Nas was talking about when he says hip-hop is dead. If you listen to the lyrics of Hip-Hop is Dead, it's all about commercialization. It's all about industry cartelization. It's about the spirit of hip-hop having been bought and sold, right, and frozen. So I think that the new lawsuits, Jay-Z's win, Madonna's win, Drake's win, will probably begin to open the door for independent labels that want to distribute sample-based music commercially to do so without licenses within certain parameters. And hopefully that'll lead to more innovation, and I'll start hearing New York music that sounds like New York music and not New York music that sounds like Southern music. No disrespect to Southern music, but there's already a South for that to happen in. I need New York music, where New York music is happening. Oh, I think we're out of time. I'll be around. I can't wait to hear the next panel, which is going to be amazing. But after the next panel, if you want to follow up and ask me questions, I'll be here, and I'm happy to chat. Thank you again to everybody, and especially to my hosts.